Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Truth and Movies, and this week we're going on some big trips. First up's pink-hued, neo-barbarian stoner epic Mandy with a howling mad Nick Cage at his most cagiest.
It's crazy evil!
Then Damien Chazelle follows up La La Land by sending Ryan Gosling to the moon. We'll find out, is it actually made of cheese?
It's a responsibility, but it's exciting to be the first.
Film Club this week, Space is Still the Place, with Philip Kaufman's 1983 aviation saga, The Right Stuff.
It's very dangerous. Count me in.
All on this week's Truth of Movies. So, hey everyone, we're here to talk movies. We're here to talk moon movies?
Moon movies.
Trip movies, to be more precise. And in the hot seats this week is Hannah Woodhead.
Hello.
And first timer, first man indeed, Anton Bittel.
Good day.
He wasn't just affecting that, he's actually from Australia, just to forewarn you.
I've only been pretending to be British all
exactly,
these years.
Exactly. So, as ever, if you want to get in touch with us about anything, it's truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. We've also got a brand spangly new Twitter account, @truthandmovies, where we're going to be focusing all our film club and Truth and Movies activities from now on. So please follow us there. And at Facebook / Little White Lies magazine, you can go and put some comments on there as well. First up this week, we're going to be talking about Mandy.
You're a special one, Mandy. I, too, am a special one. Let us be so very special together.
So what are you going to do with that, man?
I'm going hunting.
So what you hunting?
It's crazy evil!
You think you're so in love? I'll show you love. Oh man, they wronged you.
So that was from Mandy, a new film by Panos Cosmatos. It stars Nicolas Cage, Andrea Riseborough, and Linus Roach. It's the director's follow-up to a movie called Under the Black Rainbow, which I've never seen, but is reportedly as ominous as it sounds.
Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Beyond the Black Rainbow. Oh, not just under, beyond. My apologies. So Mandy, set in 1983 in the Pacific Northwest, a couple live in bliss in their woodland cabin. He works as some kind of lumberjack, I think.
Yeah.
She works as a shop assistant. They spend their evenings cooing over each other, watching nice TV shows and sort of spooning, I would say.
Yeah.
Would you say spooning's the right term for it?
I guess.
It's a sort of loving huddle.
Yeah.
And then, gosh darn it, a minibus full of religious maniacs.
Those hippies.
Hippie maniacs who love drugging people and doing horrible things to them. Not dissimilar to the Manson family. I didn't know the Manson family, but from what I assume they were like is what I'm saying that these people were like. They roll by and I guess all hell breaks loose. So, Hannah, let's call it a special film. It's a special one. It's a unique film in many ways, I think. And I think the director himself has sort of, he's described it as a pretty basic revenge movie.
Yeah.
And he's not sort of over flowery when he describes it. So it's a revenge movie, but it's over 2 hours. Why is that?
I mean, I can't speak for Panos. I've seen it twice now, and I think it's really nice that it's 2 hours, not just because I enjoyed it, but because you spend the first hour of this movie, or the first 40 minutes certainly, kind of with Red and Mandy.
Red's Nicolas Cage's character.
Sorry, yeah, should have explained this. Red is Nicolas Cage and Mandy is Andrea Riseborough, and you become quite invested in their little weird relationship, and, you know, she tells him a story about her childhood, which is quite traumatic, and we see her, like, drawing, and apparently she's very good at that, and we get some footage of her, like, reading this this great-sounding pulp paperback, and I think with revenge movies, you usually kind of only get a sort of cursory glance, and it's like, okay, I've got to now invest in this story and these characters with only kind of knowing the bare minimum. Whereas Mandy, I think you do kind of, you get a real sense that they love each other so much. And it, to me, seemed quite reasonable that after all this traumatic stuff happens, Nicolas Cage is just like, okay, well, I'm just going to kill everyone. Like, fair dues, man. I mean,
but is that not more of an exploitation thing to actually, like, make you fall in love with some people and then do horrible things to them?
Obviously, what they do to Mandy is, like, pretty horrible. But in terms of exploitation movies, like, it could have been way, way worse. You don't actually see that much, really, which I was quite pleased about. It didn't at all feel sexualized violence. It was, despite the fact that the cult leader is kind of like this, there's obviously, like, he's like, I want her, I need her. And it's very, like, okay, this he's got to... like concubines, one who she's very creepy, and the other is kind of just like this young woman who seems to not have a clue what's going on. And yeah, I was quite impressed at how non-exploitative it felt to me. I don't know, maybe I was just reading what I wanted into it.
Anton, so I've got to ask you this. As something of a horror expert, am I able to call you that?
Yeah, absolutely.
How does Mandy fit into the horror genre? Does it at all?
Well, it fits into the horror genre in that it seems to evoke demonology and demons. There are characters in the film that are presented as demons and have a whole kind of mythology behind them.
Can you tell us a bit about those? Because they're quite interesting, those. They're sort of PVC-clad bikers.
Yeah, they've clearly been styled to resemble the Cenobites from Hellraiser. They're bikers who wear, sort of what you'd call naily fetish gear, I guess. And they're summoned by a kind of an implement that's a cult device called the Horn of Abraxas, which is in fact a kind of flute. And
they always are.
And one of the things that the film does is it establishes the cult members and their kind of peripheral hangers-on as at first as having sort of supernatural powers, but in fact they're false gods. The leader of the cult, played by Linus Roach, is just a charlatan and a manipulative, unpleasant person who knows how to abuse and exploit the weak and the vulnerable. And the bikers, who at first we really are, I mean, I don't know whether this is a spoiler, but I mean, we are led to believe that they are something like demons, but they're just some Hell's Angels that have taken too much bad acid and are being manipulated. They're, again, very unpleasant people, but they are at heart people. And they are slowly replaced by the model of Nick Cage's character Red and Mandy. I mean, Mandy actually disappears from the film about halfway through.
Spoiler, maybe.
I mean, she does reappear. I mean, we see her several times after that, but she becomes less prominent. But she's always the focus of the film. And the film is, I mean, in a way, it's more about his love for her than it is about the revenge, although the revenge is an expression of his love for her. And they are both damaged people before any of the nasty stuff starts. I mean, he's clearly an alcoholic. He's a recovering alcoholic. She's literally scarred and does tell these stories about her past that sound a little disturbing. And together, they've, you know, in one another, they've found this kind of idyll that they've built around themselves. And it really is a paradise that they have in their cabin in this sort of beautiful woodland. And because we get to know them at such length before things go wrong, it really does feel like an idol has been corrupted, and then he becomes Jesus. And his side is pierced. He wears a crown of barbed wire rather than thorns. He has a nail through his hand. He does become a kind of Jesus figure. And I don't want to say he's a true god, but he's a truer god than the false gods that are opposed to him.
Well, one of the elements, so one of the things you talked about before was this idea of the deception of these false prophets. And I guess one of the tools they use in the film is drugs. I don't really want to sort of go into the details because I think when you see the film, it's quite sort of delightful how they're administered and whatnot. quite revolting, actually. But I've seen this described as a kind of stoner movie. Obviously, we would never advocate people take drugs, but does it feel like it's a sort of a film that you, to enjoy, you have to be on in some like otherworldly place in your own mind?
Lord, no.
Or is it a film that actually is actually trying to give you that experience, a legal high, if you will?
I mean, Panos's first movie is very similar in that it's incredibly slowly paced, and it is this kind of, especially more towards the beginning, I think everything in that kind of only unravels in like the last 15 minutes. But it's this thing he's sort of, I don't know if he coined the phrase, but someone coined the phrase called trans cinema, where you're kind of just like so immersed in the world, you don't really know what time is anymore. And both times I watched it, I was completely sober, like 4 in the afternoon, and I still got an awful lot out of it. I think it's maybe one of those movies that people are going to be quite keen to take home and, you know, light up before they watch, and maybe they will reach some higher plane of understanding. But I've seen a lot of fan theories about this where they're like, oh, the whole film is actually just a drug trip. And I'm like, is it? I think
that's,
you know,
that's the ultimate cop out, isn't it? I think.
The other thing is, if it's just a trip film, it's designed, like his first film, to give you a really bad trip. It's not It's not going to be a fun time if you're
no
on
one
drugs.
Comes away from that going, maybe I should try some drugs now.
Well, let's also, I mean, one of the, obviously, the key things here is we've got Nicolas Cage in a lead role, and the casting almost maybe seems too obvious. If I'm going to play devil's advocate here, it's like the film almost seems to be like a kind of, let's build a film around Nick Cage doing this kind of crescendo performance where he, you know, he's just on some sort of like ever-increasing wig out. Anton, is this his best performance? Is Nick Cage going crazy good cinema?
Okay, one of the problems with Nick Cage is you sometimes get the impression when you watch a lot of films, especially his more recent films, that every director just says to him, turn it up to 11, and he does, and we know what to expect, and it often doesn't fit the film or does fit the film but is too high-paced for the film to cope with. And in this film, I think actually, although it is getting talked about as Nick Cage going all out and doing his Cage rage and so on, but I think actually this film does something very different and treats him as an actor in a different way, because it's the film that's crazy. And he's actually quite centered and remarkably staid. There is one prolonged sequence in a bathroom where he does the Cage, although it's a sequence that is, it's so ridiculous and absurd and yet so intense that you're actually, as a viewer, you're not quite sure how you're supposed to respond to it. And I found that a really interesting and difficult scene. But other than that, the crazy stuff is all happening around him, and he's just in the center. He's like the eye of the storm. I mean, he is delivering the vengeance, but one of the ways in which he's been restrained is that he actually has very few lines in the film. He's not delivering his crazy-eyed lines. He's just caught in the middle of this incredible mess and is trying to struggle and find a way out of it. I don't think he will be recognised in this film for this, but I do think it's one of his more restrained roles, and he's not playing it at 11.
There's a really good video, I think it was a GQ video, about where he breaks down his most iconic roles, and I would highly recommend people find it, because he talks about like Moonstruck and Bad Lieutenant 2, and it's just really like fun watching him talk about his quote-unquote process. But when he was originally sort of circling this movie, Panos asked him to play the character of Jeremiah Sand, who's the cult leader, and he was like, no, I don't want to play that one. I want to play Red. I think Red's more interesting. And it's great that he said that, because I think seeing him as a kind of crazy cult leader wouldn't be that interesting to me. I think, like Anton said, there's this bathroom sequence, and we were in the same screening, and people were kind of like laughing at that, and I was like, no, this is really sad. Do you not see what's happening? Like, he's giving a kind of very you know, a tortured performance. It's, you know, this man is in deep pain, and I really like that he gets to kind of be full-on crazy Nick Cage, but with a purpose this time. It doesn't just feel like he's just walked onto the set and started yelling at people. It feels like, yeah, this makes total sense. This is a man just trying to kind of do the right thing, and yeah, that's pretty much the movie, yeah.
I would say after the ordeal he kind of goes through prior to that scene, you know, it's a rare occasion where it feels, I maybe wouldn't say restrained, but justified, at least.
It is one of these weird scenes where what he's going through is, it's a very intense emotional experience for the character, but he's sitting on a toilet throughout it, and that just somehow makes it completely absurd.
And the bathroom is absurd as well. I mean, I think the production design in this is so great as well. Yeah. Like
that floral wallpaper.
The bathroom's like yellow floral wallpaper. Very, very, like, I mean, the film is set in the 80s, but it feels like that bathroom is like solid 70s. Like, that's my grandparents' bathroom. And the rest of the set design as well, like, their house is so like beautiful. It has their bedroom's got these like glass walls so they can look into the forest. And there's this scene where he goes to meet a drug chemist and it looks like a airplane hangar, I guess. And I just think so much kind of thought and love has gone into every single detail in this film, even if you're not into the kind of Nick Cage being Nick Cage element. It makes me very happy that films like this are still made and that we can go to the cinema and watch them. And I'm super excited to see what Panos does next after this.
I mean, let me ask you one last thing before we move on to scores. I mean, this was a sort of reaction I had to it. I mean, I was sort of watching this film aghast. You know when you're watching a movie and you're like, this is the film of a free man. This is a man doing exactly what he wants to do, the way he wants to do it. There is no decision that some kind of toadying producer with a ponytail has come up to him and said, sorry, kid, we can't do that. It's not going to play in the boonies. So is that very idea of a film that is a kind of almost, it feels like an untainted vision, even if it might not be an untainted vision, is that itself a kind of positive?
You know, it's funny because I often complain, I think I've complained on this show about directors who need an editor and need someone to tell them when they should just not do things. But yeah, I think it is nice to see a film where someone has clearly just run with it and done what they want to do. I know that with Beyond the Black Rainbow, he financed it by using the residuals from his father's film Tombstone. And again, it feels like he's just kind of been like, okay, I've got an idea, I'm going to do it. And I think one of the frustrating things about this film for me is that the release has been so sort of all over the place. And it's finally now going to be in cinemas. For a while, it looked like it was just going to go straight on to on demand, which would have been a huge shame. I think it does benefit from being seen on a big screen.
Oh, yeah. Especially for the sound.
But it's now become like a kind of cult hit. I've been reading in America that it's, you know, although it's been playing on very few screens, all those screens are sold out.
And it's
running and running and running.
Here, the Prince Charles in London have sold 1,000 tickets, which is crazy for one movie over like a week or so that they're playing it. I think it's a real testament to A, the power of like social media marketing and the fact that people have got out there and said like, yeah, I love this movie, go and watch this movie. And also Panos himself and Aaron Stuart Han, who wrote the film with him, have been very active about saying, if you are a cinema who wants to show this movie, let us know and we'll see what we can do. Which I think is so, it's, again, it goes back to them having the kind of freedom to do this. A lot of directors, I think, don't have that kind of freedom, and we need more of that out there.
So let's get some scores in. Anton, so what we do here, just to explain for the newbie, we do anticipation in enjoyment in retrospect score out of 5, with a little comment on each one, as we would do for our print reviews.
Well, I don't really believe in the value of anticipation. If I'm being completely honest, I had very high anticipation for this film and probably would have given it a 5 because Beyond the Black Rainbow, I just adore. And for enjoyment, I think my jaw was on the floor throughout the film. So again, I suspect I would give it 5. For in retrospect, now that's probably a little harder. The only problem I have with the film is that it's an experience, and it's like an audiovisual experience that is completely overwhelming when you're sitting in the theatre. But actually, I'm not entirely sure that it gives you a lot to take home with you afterwards. It is a very simple revenge plot. I mean, there's lots of colourful details, but the plot itself is very straightforward. So I suspect I'd give it 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anna? And that's really interesting to me because I it was like a 4 in anticipation and a 4 and a 5 for me in retrospect. I think although, like Anton says, it's quite a simple, like a linear, like, here is a man who has a problem, he's going to solve the problem plot. I've been kind of thinking about it since I first saw it like 3 months ago and kind of still thinking in images from it. I think it's a very, you know, you'll just be minding your own business, and especially like the ending shot will just pop in your head. I'm like, man, that was a great movie. So yeah, like still a 5 in retrospect for me.
Wow, so big scores for Panos Cosmatos's Mandy, which is out on Friday. Next up, Damien Chazelle's First Man. So we got Ryan Gosling back in collaboration with Damien Chazelle after the very successful neon-hued LA musical La La Land. This new one is a chronicle of how Neil Armstrong became the first man, air quotes, on the moon. There's focus on the abortive attempts of sending a rocket through the atmosphere, details of family life, and it's set against the backdrop of the space race and the Cold War. Here's a clip of Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, et al. At a press conference prior to the big launch.
Brian.
Neil, if it does turn out, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that when a thought hits you? Gosh, suppose that flight successful?
We're planning on that flight being successful.
I just meant how you feel about being a part of history.
I think I can shed some light here. It's a responsibility, but it's exciting to be the first. If my wife is excited, she keeps slipping jewelry into my PPK.
You're planning on taking some of her jewelry to the moon, Buzz?
Sure. What fella wouldn't want to give his wife bragging rights?
Neil, will you take anything?
If I had a choice, I'd take more fuel.
As we all know, to fill in the story, Damien Chazelle was pipped at the post at the Oscars for La La Land. Moonlight beat it at the final hurdle. And Anton, I'd like to hear from you. Maybe you're not a massive awards geek, but I'd love to know, does this feel like Damien Chazelle has thought, okay, I missed that shot, I've got to do something which absolutely secures the Oscar this time round?
Well, I mean, I'm sure all prominent filmmakers have that somewhere in the back of their mind. I'm not sure whether he succeeded, although, frankly, I don't think he succeeded with his last film either. But in the clip that we just heard, we hear Neil Armstrong, played by Ryan Gosling, being asked repeatedly what he thinks about the mission. And the last question that he's asked is, what you feel about being a part of this? And he doesn't answer. And there's a pause, and then Buzz Aldrin interrupts him. And in a sense, that's essential to the film's core theme, because this is really a film about a man with very stunted emotions. It's a man who cannot express the way he feels. The film begins with a tragedy. His young daughter, Karen, dies of cancer. And he just never recovers from this, but is so emotionally constipated that he's incapable of talking about his problems and his feelings with friends, with the other astronauts that are on the Gemini project and then the Apollo project with him, and even with his own wife, played by Claire Foy. And it's a strange focus. In a sense, it's what makes the film interesting, in that you have a story that you might expect will be grand vistas and giant sort of spectacles of outer space. But in fact, First Man is a very telling title, because it really is about the man first and not about the mission. But the problem is that he's not a very engaging man, because he's so emotionally constipated that there's very little for us to relate to or to like about him. And I found that I very quickly lost interest in him as a character. It's just he was always there, so you have to focus on him. But he's so lost in his own emotionlessness and he's so inert that I just couldn't relate to him at all. I think I understand correctly that I certainly didn't see this in IMAX. Parts of it were filmed in IMAX, and I believe you also
didn't
see it in IMAX. It's possible that we're both going to do the film an injustice, because I have read accounts from people who have seen it in IMAX who say that it really does deliver a spectacle at the end on the moon that is like nothing that we've ever seen before, and that requires the full IMAX screen to be appreciated. But I must say, before that, the film is quite determinedly and deliberately an anti-spectacle. Whenever there are trips beyond the Earth's atmosphere, the focus is always on a character's face. If we see outside, it's either a close-up hugging the spacecraft, or else it's a vision of outer space framed by a small window within the space vessel. And so it feels really much more like a trip into kind of inner space. It's a kind of an intimate look at what space travel is like. And it's only really towards the end that we start getting anything like the vistas that are the cliche of space travel films. You know, we get a waltz when there's a spacecraft in the air, like 2001 A Space Odyssey. But the film has come under a lot of criticism from the American right for not focusing on the planting of the US flag on the moon's surface. Now, no matter what you think about that politically and whether you think that is a political statement or not, I mean, personally, I think you do see the flag very clearly on the moon's surface. It's just a non-issue. But what is quite clear is that Chazelle is deliberately avoiding showing all the scenes that we've already seen of the moon. And he's trying to show a different perspective. But that perspective is, it's always focused on Neil Armstrong. In a way, the film, it's a terrible reduction of the film. But what the film is about is a man who is distanced from everybody And the way in which he realizes his aloofness is he finds the most distant place he can be from everybody, which is on the moon, and finds the perfect place to bury his emotions there, somewhere that's dark and dank and that no one is ever going to see.
So here's a question. Everyone knows how the moon landings ended up, you know, unless you believe in conspiracy theories about Stanley Kubrick, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that this kind of idea of the fait accompli, the fact that we already know what happens, damages the sort of dramatic impact of this film?
No, because I didn't watch Dunkirk and think, oh, well, I know how this is going to turn out. You know, I think films like this where you know exactly how it's going to play out, the onus is on the director and the screenwriter to tell you what you don't know, which is about, in this case, it's about Neil Armstrong. But as Anton has said, Neil Armstrong is at least in this film, he seems like a pretty boring character. He's an ordinary man who happens to do an extraordinary thing, especially when you have him kind of squaring off against Buzz Aldrin, who's played by Corey Stoll, who is like, he's great in this film, who's the kind of wisecracking, like, flyboy, I guess.
I'm pretty sure Buzz Aldrin is not that happy with this film. his the depiction of him as a kind of goofball.
Yeah.
Everyone
kind of like, shut up, Buzz, every 2 seconds. He's a bit of a shady character. But you watch the movie and you're watching Buzz and you're like, I want a film about Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin seems way more like interesting. And there's this great scene where Ryan Gosling is talking to his children after much chiding from his wife, Janet. She's like, Neil, you've got to tell the children you're going to the moon. He's like, okay, tell the children I'm going to the moon. And he sits them down and he has like a press conference with his children. They ask him questions and he's like sat there with his arm, with his hands kind of clasped, like, yes, no, like, it will be a difficult... And it's just, it's funny, but I don't know if it was kind of meant to be funny. I think it just kind of is testament to how stiff and robotic Neil Armstrong comes across in this movie.
I mean, it's a good thing to mention because the point I want to come to next is the casting of Ryan Gosling. And my take on this was that Ryan Gosling is someone, I mean, I don't know if you guys have noticed this in him, but he's an expert jowl actor. Do you know what I mean by that? There are many scenes in films where it's the camera on his face and he will be sort of grinding his teeth so the kind of muscles just behind his eyes will kind of pulsate and wriggle in his face. That's his kind of, you know, his sort of static look, like, I'm about to explode. I've got this kind of writhing anger or this sadness inside of me that is just kind of waiting to come out. There's a lot of jowl acting in this film. I mean, this is maybe kill me, but like, a boring actor as a boring character is a bit of a... Is it two negatives making a positive?
I don't know. I'm an admirer of Ryan Gosling's
performance. Sorry, that was a loaded question.
So it's hard for me to engage directly with that question. But I do think that, you know, it's true that Ryan Gosling is also very pretty to look at. He's very handsome. And that is part of his appeal to a lot of viewers. And that probably helps because I think it would have been difficult for any actor to find something interesting about this character the way he's been written. I mean, in a sense, he can't ever show anything or display anything because the whole point of the character is that he keeps everything hidden. He keeps everything cocooned within his little sort of man suit. So, I think probably a good thing that Ryan Gosling is there because it will certainly inspire some people to go and see the film who might otherwise not have. But I wonder whether they're going to be getting what they consider the full Gosling.
Let's loop back to something you mentioned, actually, about the planting of the American flag. Because, I mean, this is a kind of... When I saw the film, I certainly kind of... I guess I understood why people were talking about it, because I think the film, if it was a militantly apolitical film that wasn't looking at the ideas of America, ideas of like America versus Russia, like domestic policy, how money was being funneled to the space program and potentially being taken away from like healthcare and housing projects and things like that. Is it a political film? I mean, is Damien Chazelle trying to have his political cake and eat it in a way?
I don't think he is. I think it's, having now seen the film, I think the flag thing was a total sort of a storm in a teacup. And I think there's this great moment where Claire Foy, who I think gets kind of a raw deal in this film, she's talking to Kyle Chandler, who plays the kind of like a mission control guy, and she says, you're just a bunch of boys playing at like you don't know anything kind of moment, and it's her one, like, you know, she really gets to explode, as she's quite good at doing. And maybe it is a political issue in that it's kind of talking about the hubris of the American government, particularly during the 60s, but I think it also speaks to the Russian government and the fact that, the space race was kind of just like a mass dick waving across the Atlantic. And that, I guess, is political. But yeah, I don't think it's really overtly a political film at all. I think it's really, and that for me, I think is maybe the problem I had with it, is it's very reluctant to take a lane. And it doesn't, for me watching it, I was just frustrated. I was like, this, God, the amount of sacrifice that went into this just to, you know, go to space. And maybe that makes me unpatriotic. I'm watching a movie about the moon landings and going, oh, this was like a big waste of money.
Wow. But the reason I ask is because in the middle of the film, there is this...
Scott Heron.
Yeah.
Whitey on the moon.
I couldn't say if it was archive footage or something that he'd shot, but it sort of sits smack dab right in the middle of the film. And it feels like this is the point where we're going to sort of broaden out and we're going to talk about America and what the process of traveling to space actually means for a country and what people actually think about it. But then it sort of draws a line and says, right, we've done that. Now let's do the fun bit and go to the moon.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way as you do. I kind of thought, when that scene came, I thought, oh, at last there's going to be, you know, something beyond this little cocoon that the main character lives in that will be introduced to the film. But in fact, it just never goes anywhere. And in fact, the space mission, it's not just that the space mission is sort of the culmination of the space race between the two superpowers of the world. It feels like the space mission, the entire purpose of it, as far as the film is concerned, is to allow this private individual his little moment of release. It's such a weird ending. But I didn't really feel that the film was interested in politics. They were always at the margin of it.
All right, should we get some scores for this one? Hannah, do you want to go first this time?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a 4 in anticipation. I'm a big booster of Whiplash. I really liked it. La La Land, I enjoyed, but, you know, it's a bit like Candy Floss. You know, you don't really want to go again after you've had it the first time. So, yeah, like a 4 anticipation and then like a 3. I can appreciate the film on a effort level. Obviously a lot of time and money has gone into it, but it didn't really work for me. I was left quite cold by it. And then retrospect, yeah, like I don't want to give it a 2 because that seems petty, but it is a 2 for me. Like, I have no desire to watch this again.
Anton?
And I think in anticipation, I was like, just like Hannah, I loved Whiplash. I didn't really like La La Land, so I'd say a 3. For enjoyment, I'd probably say a 2 because, frankly, I was bored. But in retrospect, actually, it perked up a little bit for me because I did find sort of thinking through its themes and the weird route it takes through what really was quite a monumental program, the way it individualizes it, I think was something I liked more. So maybe a 3 or a 4. I'm going to say a 4.
Okay. Thanks, guys. So that's First Man, Damien Chazelle, Ryan Gosling, Claire Foy, out in cinemas this Friday and probably coming to an Oscar season near you. So without further ado, let's move on to this week's film club.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We've got a letter this week, David in California. That's where he is. That's not his name. Hey, guys. You talked about black superhero movies on this week's Film Club. It took me back to my first black superhero movie, The Meteor Man, brackets, 1993. It's probably an absurd of a watch as Spawn, but a ton of black talent from the era made appearances. Plus, who doesn't want to watch a school teacher battle a gang of bleach blonde drug dealing gangsters? Anyway, I thought it could be a future Film Club or a lazy Sunday, and I doubt this movie ever made its way to the UK. Keep up the good work. Meteor Man, any of you partaken?
I have not seen it.
I can't say I'm familiar, no. This was the year after I was born, though, so, you know.
That's the good get-out clause.
I was one.
It's a film that I remember, I've never seen, but it's one of those that I remember on the video shop shelves consistently.
So it did make its way to the UK.
I think it was a straight-to-VHS, because it's more of a comedy than a superhero film. The guy on the cover is wearing a sort of ill-fitting... Oh, actually, I can't remember if it's ill-fitting, but it's sort of a meteor-based leotard, powder blue. But no, it's definitely one that I want to sort of take a look at. In fact, a colleague and friend, Ash Clark, who now is the programmer for BAM Cinematheque in New York, did an entire season on black superhero films. So maybe one day, hopefully, by the time Black Panther 2 inevitably comes around, he can bring it back home. So let's get on to this week's actual film club, which is The Right Stuff. Here's a clip.
On October 14th, 1947, Captain Charles Yeager shattered the sound barrier, propelled man into the future, and the search began for a new breed of men. Men who were fearless.
You've heard about our project.
Sounds dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
Count me in.
So that's from Philip Kaufman's 1983 film, The Right Stuff, which we're taking another look at this week in tandem with the release of Damien Chazelle's First Man. This film is based on the 1979 book by New Journalism Diane Tom Wolfe. It's about the space race, this time men orbiting the Earth. But also it's about the history of modern aviation and the men who risk life and limb to attain these crazy new speeds. In the clip there, you heard about Chuck Yeager breaking the sound barrier. Amazing performance in the film by Sam Shepard. So when the film originally came out, it was something of a flop. It didn't make much of a connection with an audience. And I mean, but it's since grown in stature. It's a kind of critical favourite. A lot of American critics put it on their kind of best of the decade in the 1980s. Is it understandable that maybe it's not a film that's going to be like a big box office weekend draw?
Yeah, I think I can imagine this was a bit of a hard sell for audiences. So it came along in the production schedule just after Heaven's Gate came out, which was a, widely derided as a self-indulgent mess, but has undergone a sort of reevaluation now where people are like, actually, it's really good. And yes, it should be 3 hours long, which is what people say about The Right Stuff. But at the time, the production company were like, no, we're not doing this again. We're not having another fiasco on our hands. So they had to get another financer in to back it. And I'm glad they did that. I think it's definitely a better film about the space race than First Man is.
Anton, when did you first see it?
Oh gosh, I saw it decades ago, but I can't remember exactly when that was. I love the film. I mean, I was actually really glad to have an opportunity to rewatch it because I did enjoy it the first time and was wondering whether I still would, and wondering how it would hold up in comparison to something like First Man. And I agree with Hannah completely that it's a much better film. It's strange because although it's again about something like the space race, it begins with the sound barrier being broken by Chuck Yeager, and then moves on to the first space program and attempts to get out of the atmosphere. And you'd expect from that précis something like this story of American triumphalism. And I mean, in a sense, it does deliver that, but it's always offset by this notion of death and failure and of the best being left behind. And I mean, I mentioned it begins with Chuck Yeager. In fact, the script was originally supposed to be written by, it was written by William Goldman, and then William Goldman left the project because the director, Philip Kaufman, insisted that Chuck Yeager be included and, in fact, be the main part of the story. And Chuck Yeager wasn't in William Goldman's script. William Goldman wrote a much more patriotic script. And Chuck Yeager broke the speed barrier just after the Second World War and was excluded from the space program because he hadn't had a college education and just wasn't the kind of sexy new look that America wanted for its public image. But actually, the way in which he is characterized is as this kind of figure of masculinity from America's mythic past. He's almost the Marlborough man. He rides in to the airport on a horse smoking a cigarette. He's extremely laconic, and he doesn't talk about what he's going to do. He just does it.
Apparently that's a slightly falsified account of the reality.
Absolutely.
Of him just like literally walking onto a landing strip, jumping in at the nearest fighter jet and them going, "Oh, it's Chuck, yeah, go for broke."
Yeah, no, the flights, in reality, the flights he took were very, very carefully planned. But in the film, it's presented as he just jumps on board and doesn't get permission and just does whatever he wants and, you know, breaks the latest record that someone else has broken because he's always going to be ahead of everybody else. But the point is that he's left behind and you're introduced to a team of sort of younger, newer pilots who never really, perhaps with the exception of Ed Harris's John Glenn, they never really match up to his stature. They're all in one way or another very flawed individuals, whereas he's just a straightforward hero. And so although you're watching takeoff and liftoff, you're also watching decline. And I think that's an interesting and kind of complex story of America and American history. In fact, it's also looking at masculinity specifically in very unusual ways. The achievements or the failures of the different pilots are often sexualized, or at least metaphorically sexualized. Gus Grissom, who is the second astronaut to actually go into the beyond the Earth's atmosphere, played by Fred Ward, when he lands back in the water at the end of his mission, he, according to the film — this supposedly isn't true, but according to the film — he panics and he opens the hatch of the landing craft before he should have. And as a result, the landing craft sinks in the water and he's only just rescued. And it's all a bit of an embarrassing fail, like everything just goes wrong. And he says, "I didn't do anything. I was just lying there. It just blew. Must have been a technical malfunction. The hatch just blew." And he says this to his wife as well. And it's so obviously, it's as though he's talking about premature ejaculation, except that instead he's talking about the space mission. And this idea that his failure as a pilot is actually his emasculation, and he's sidelined from then on in the film. He's this kind of embarrassing figure that nobody wants to be seen near. And the first trip beyond the atmosphere is Alan Shepard, played by Scott Glenn. And the focus of that scene is actually, it's not his struggles to survive the intense pressures of flying up and beyond the atmosphere under all that heat. The focus is on his desperation to pee and his inability to control his bladder, which again is a very emasculating way to present this, I think.
I mean, that's interesting you say that, because I think rewatching it, I'd seen it many years ago myself, and giving it a rewatch this week, I was struck by, and I think this is maybe something that's missing in action in First Man very much, is this kind of undertow of humour. And some of the humour is actually quite broad sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a... I was thinking about Jeff Goldblum and Harry Shearer in this movie, who kind of crop up as two NASA recruiters and have this like great double act, only for like maybe 10 minutes out of this 3-hour epic.
There's a running joke of Goldblum running to the president to tell him the latest news from Russia, and they're like, "Yeah, we already know."
But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I think it's, you know, it's a very long film, and the thing that makes you invested is that it's not all kind of like serious space. It's, you know, there are funny things, there are funny moments. The characters themselves are interesting and dynamic, and I think it helps that they're played by actors who have that charisma about them. I mean, Ed Harris, kind of, for me, it was interesting to see him kind of when he was young, because now I mainly know him from the roles he's done in recent, you know, like in Mother and in Westworld, where he's playing kind of like quite creepy characters. And in this, he's very, you know, very...
he's very avuncular.
Very charming. And the other thing that I think it has over First Man is that the female characters get more of a... more to do in this. You kind of... There's this whole scene, which they had a very similar scene in First Man, where one of the wives' husbands has died during a mission, and they kind of go over and like talk to him, like, "Are you okay?" But it feels so much more sincere in The Right Stuff, and so much more kind of... you feel that loss more. You feel that it's... you get to see them having a conversation about what it's like to be married to these men children who kind of don't want to talk about their feelings and just want to go and fly into space. And the one thing that really surprised me about this is how much it hates Lyndon B. Johnson. Like, there's a scene late in the film where they're waiting to go on the mission and Lyndon B. Johnson's like there in the car outside the wife's house and he's like, oh, I hope he dies because it would be really good if I can go in and comfort her. And it's like, I'm sure that Lyndon would not have been okay with this. Like, he's really portrayed as a bit of a sleazeball.
I mean, I think one of the things I loved about revisiting this again was this idea of these men who maybe they're not thinking constantly about the fact that they're on the precipice of death, especially someone like Dennis Quaid's character, who is almost like a kind of jock. He's all about having fun. You know, he has this kind of urge to be a pilot, to go to space, to break these records, I guess. And there's a kind of tragic hue to the whole thing of just these kind of very... they feel like very normal people in the film.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And that's what's kind of nice about it.
It still feels quite unique. You know, its structure is very loose. It's a saga. It's almost got a literary feel to it. But it's obvious that there are modern directors who are obviously fans of the film. Do you see the right stuff in many sort of contemporary works, maybe?
I think you see it in First Man. I think it's quite clear that he's studied the right stuff, even though he often deliberately deviates from the kind of template that it offers. But they look like very obvious deviations, like he's making an effort to.
I also thought that Christopher Nolan has obviously studied this frame by frame. I mean, Interstellar is almost like, although it's a very grounded film in many ways, in a sort of human way, it does have these kind of quite weird, almost sort of surreal... you know, when they're looking out the window into space, it's almost kind of psychedelic. It's not your kind of, we're trying to give you a kind of honest depiction of what it would feel like. There is a sort of like, let's go inside your head and use some psychedelics here.
And we should say the film came out in 1983, which is the same year in which Mandy is set, and is also the first year in which Nicolas Cage had a starring role in Valley Girl.
Wow. On that note...
I have one more point. Talking about this film's influence in the rest of culture, and this is something I realised watching the film. I'd never seen it before. I watched it first time last night. And there's a scene, which I guess is iconic, I didn't know this, where they're walking, all the pilots are walking down the hallway in slow-mo in their astronaut gear. And this scene has... there's like an homage to this in Monsters, Inc. And I never realised that's what it was riffing on. But there we go.
One of my great pleasures is actually... watching films and then belatedly understanding Simpsons jokes. I mean, there's pretty much like one a month.
I mean, if you watch the Homer Goes to Space episode of The Simpsons, I'm sure, you know, there are the right stuff jokes in there.
Absolutely. Like. Moving on for a final little bit, we're going to talk about the London Film Festival, which is actually starting... by the time you hear this podcast, it will be happening. It's a massive two-week festival with lots and lots of new films, lots of undiscovered gems, treasures from the archive, events, talks, everything, all happening in London. Some happening not in London. There's the premiere of Peterloo that's happening in Manchester. Obviously, it's a massive programme. So what I'm going to do, ask you guys, is if you had one golden ticket to see one movie that you could give to your busy mate in the world who's not seen any movies. And just to add, that busy mate has exactly the same film taste as you. They're a clone of you, in fact.
Well, I'm always drawn to Michael Blythe's Cult Strand because of my own interests. And there's a film playing in that strand. It's a very strong strand this year. You could see almost anything from it. But there's a film by a director, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, called Quarks, which is Q-U-A-R-X-X.
Right.
And it's called All the Gods in the Sky. It looks a little bit like a Jeunet et Caro film. Its aesthetic is like that, but it's very dark and very messed up about two siblings, a brother and a sister, who are locked into a very toxic relationship with one another that began with an horrific accident in their childhood and has seeped into their present. And they're both seeking a kind of higher authority to settle the difference between them. They're both seeking a very different kind of higher authority from one another, mm-hmm. I might add, which is why it's All the Gods rather than God in the Sky. And it's funny and beautiful and really shocking. I mean, this is a film that there's a few scenes in it that genuinely shocked me, which does not happen very often.
Right, if it shocks Anton Bertel, then you've got a problem there. So that's All the Gods in the Sky. Hannah, what have you got for us?
Well, I feel like I've talked a lot about all the great films I saw at TIFF, and lots of the great films I saw at TIFF are at London. But I'm going to talk about a film called Thunder Road, which I saw yesterday, which is a smaller film, written, directed, produced and starring this actor called Jim Cummings. It's based on his short film, which won the Sundance like Grand Jury Short Film Prize in 2016.
That's a red light for me.
Well, I don't care about your opinions. It's for a clone of me, David.
Oh, of course.
It's not for a clone of David.
Fair enough.
About a small town cop who, his mother's just died and he's kind of coming to terms with that whilst also locked in this very bitter battle for custody of his daughter. That all sounds very heavy, and it is a very sad film at moments, but it's also very, very funny, and it touches a lot on kind of grief, fatherhood. But for me specifically, the thing that I really liked about it is how much it deals with masculinity and the pressure on particularly men in kind of small town America to be very stoic and not in touch with their emotions and very like manly. And I think it's just a really lovely, very beautiful film that I would recommend people seek out.
Cool. Well, I'm going to say I haven't seen the film, but I'm really excited to see a film called Maya by a director called Mia Hansen-Love, who has made some of my favourite films of recent times. She made a film called Eden, and she did a film a couple of years ago called Things to Come with Isabelle Huppert. And this is her new movie, and I have a bit of a kind of personal tradition of watching her movies at the London Film Festival every year. So I'm glad that this one was programmed, and I'm really excited to see it. So maybe I can let you know about how that went in the future, but I'm sure it'll be great because she's one of those directors who I can't really see bad things in. So quick note on next week, we're going to be looking at the new Halloween plus Cannes competition entry Dogman from Matteo Garrone. Our film club, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to throw it out to you, the public, in that we're going to be talking about one of the Halloween films. But here's the thing. We're asking you, what's the best Halloween film that's not the new Halloween and that's not the original Halloween? So within that kind of middle sandwich of Halloween films, Anton, you want to sort of tip the scales anyway here?
Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Right, there we go. I've got a feeling it might go that way. I've already heard a few people say that so far.
I've seen some people saying Rob Zombie's Halloween, and I think I'm doing next
they're saying
week.
No, they're saying Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
So, even worse.
Even worse. So, yeah, tune in next week to find out which one we go for. So, but we'll let you know in advance. So, yeah, thanks to Hannah. Thanks to Anton. Thanks for your maiden voyage. We'll be back next week. And this has been a 7 Digital production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.